Welcome to OncLive On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. OncLive On Air is a podcast from OncLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, OncLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. OncLive is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania for a State of the Science Summit on lung cancer. At the meeting, faculty from the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and Fox Chase Cancer Center discussed how chemoimmunotherapy has changed the standard of care in stage 4 non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer, highlighted how upfront immunotherapy has become a pivotal component of treatment in squamous non-small cell lung cancer, and explain how the success of immunotherapy in lung cancer has set the stage for future research efforts. In addition, faculty examined PD-L1 expression and tumor mutational burden as biomarkers of immunotherapy response in non-small cell lung cancer and provided insight into how to overcome acquired resistance to targeted therapy. First, we sat down with the chair of the meeting, Antoinette Wozniak, MD, FACP, FASCO, who is the Associate Director of Clinical Research at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, Hillman Cancer Center, a co-director of the UPMC Lung Cancer Center of Excellence, and the director of the Lung Cancer Disease Unit at UPMC. Wozniak told us that the emergence of immunotherapy agents in the stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer as well as the small cell lung cancer treatment paradigms has led to improved survival outcomes for patients. Listen on to hear Wozniak discuss the promise of immunotherapy in lung cancer, as well as ongoing research efforts further exploring this approach.
It's a difficult stage to treat because of the heterogeneity of the disease, and there's a lot of questions still to be answered about the best treatment and what does advance the survival in this disease. We'll be talking primarily about the PACIFIC study, which did advance the treatment, and it was a study in which patients with unresectable stage 3 lung cancer received chemotherapy and radiation, and then were randomized on a 2-to-1 basis to get durvalumab, which is a PD-L1 inhibitor, immunotherapy for a year, versus placebo. And basically, the patients who did get the durvalumab had a significant improvement in survival as a result of the treatment. The toxicities were acceptable, including incidence of pneumonitis, which would be of concern in patients who receive immunotherapy after radiation. There was a retrospective look at the PD-L1 marker, and it appears that the patients who were PD-L1 negative really did not benefit as well, but this was a retrospective look. Not all the patients provided tissue for PD-L1 analysis, so it's a little unclear what this means, but the results of this trial resulted in durvalumab being approved by the FDA for maintenance therapy after chemoradiation in stage 3 disease. Right now it's given after chemoradiation, usually when the patients recover from the chemotherapy and the radiation and are able to take it. Actually, the patients on the trial who were able to start it sooner tended to do a little bit better. What we do know about immunotherapy in small cell lung cancer came from the EMPOWER 133 trial. Patients received 4 cycles of a chemotherapy plus or minus atezolizumab, and there was a 2-month improvement in median survival for the patients who received the immunotherapy. And although that may sound like a modest improvement, we have not had a positive trial in small cell in probably 25 years. It did indicate that there was a role for immunotherapy in small cell. The Caspian trial is a trial, was a 3-arm trial of chemotherapy versus chemotherapy plus durvalumab versus chemotherapy plus durvalumab and tremelimumab. And only the first 2 arms were reported, and that is the chemo versus the chemo plus durvalumab trial. And it actually also had a similar improvement in survival, this time by close to 3 months, and survival curves that looked similar. So we do have another confirming study that immunotherapy does add some benefit for patients with small cell lung cancer. It is likely that durvalumab will get approved for use in this particular situation. But I think what the both trials have done is open the door to more investigations using immunotherapy in small cell, either in combination with other chemotherapy or in limited stage disease where we are not using it routinely yet. So I think it just opened the door for more trials.
Next, we spoke with Hussein Borghai, DO, MS, who told us that the emergence of chemoimmunotherapy combinations in stage 4 non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer has resulted in clear survival gains for patients regardless of PD-L1 expression. In our interview, Borghai, a professor in the Department of Hematology and Oncology, Chief of Thoracic Medical Oncology, and co-director of the Immune Monitoring Facility at Fox Chase Cancer Center, highlighted pivotal trials examining the use of chemoimmunotherapy in metastatic non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer, ongoing research efforts, and exciting biomarkers on the horizon.
Almost universally, these trials confirmed the superiority of chemotherapy plus immunotherapy in patients with metastatic non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer, regardless of the PD-L1 level. PD-L1s were checked, obviously, because that is a biomarker that we're all interested in, but it doesn't seem that PD-L1 selection is quite as important when it comes to chemo-IO combinations. Now, clearly, the data does show that progression-free survival is better for patients that have any level of PD-L1 expression, meaning that PD-L1 negative patients did not have as much of a benefit as far as PFS is concerned with chemotherapy plus immunotherapy. However, overall survival does seem to favor the use of chemo plus immunotherapy. The magnitude of benefit is larger and better in some studies, for instance, in KEYNOTE 189 with the combination of platinum plus pemetrexed plus pembrolizumab, but nonetheless, I think a majority of them do support the use of chemo combinations with checkpoint inhibitors. We are not curing our patients, or the majority of them don't seem to be cured, so there's still a lot of work to be done. For instance, one of the major areas that we're all concentrating on right now is what to do for patients who have had chemo and immunotherapy, or nowadays, if they get IO-IO up front, what do we do with them at the time of progression? Clearly, if they haven't had any chemo up front, the next line of therapy could be chemo, but is that really the appropriate way of treating them? What is going to be the responses in that category? What are the potential toxicities in that category? What if somebody has had chemo plus IO? What do we do with them at the time of progression? So these are areas of active research, and there's a lot of interest in developing potentially other checkpoint inhibitors or other immunotherapy mechanism to sort of assess clinical efficacy in a patient population that has had both chemo and IO. If any of those show promise, then I think there would be a segue into moving those compounds or those regimens into the frontline setting so that we can improve on, you know, survival of patients in the frontline. The key thing to remember for lung cancer patients, and I think this is data that we see recurrently, is that unfortunately many of our patients never really see second or third line therapies. So it is imperative for us to find things that work, move them to the frontline setting where we can capture almost 100% of our patients as opposed to waiting for the second or third line. So I'm excited about some of the potential combinations that have been investigated. For instance, combination of immunotherapy with a VEGF inhibitor. There's a lot of good science to say that VEGF inhibition can be important in terms of immune modulation. So I look forward to some of those results, and then hopefully we'll refine those and move them to the upfront setting, and we go one step at a time. My hat's off to people who do biomarker research. It's a very, very difficult area. We all know about PD-L1. TMB has received a lot of attention, whether it's justified or not. I think it is a biomarker that we still are playing with in the clinic, trying to see if we can identify specific patient populations. There's blood-based TMB, there's tissue-based TMB. There are a couple of different platforms that are being investigated and looked at. Beyond that, there are other T-cell activation markers that have been looked at as a potential predictor of response to immunotherapy. There's an interferon gamma signature that, you know, a couple of years it's really hot, a year or two is not so hot. We go back and forth with it, again, because of the difficulties and sort of really knowing what the immune system does and how it is impacted by different drugs, and therefore how these biomarkers might play a role in there.
When Liza C. Villarouz, MD, stopped by, she shared that data from pivotal clinical trials such as KEYNOTE-024 and KEYNOTE-407 have indicated the crucial role of upfront immunotherapy in the treatment of patients with advanced squamous non-small cell lung cancer, whether these agents are being used alone or in combination. Listen on to hear Villarouz, an associate professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center Hillman Cancer Center, discuss the data with immunotherapy in squamous non-small cell lung cancer.
KEYNOTE-024, which looked at pembrolizumab monotherapy versus chemotherapy, and the progression-free survival for patients in that clinical trial was actually equivalent to the overall survival associated with platinum doublets in patients with squamous cell carcinoma. So really significantly advanced the field. This was specifically in patients with high PD-L1 expressing tumors and established PD-L1 as a biomarker for immunotherapy, monotherapy in patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer. The KEYNOTE-407 clinical trial, which looked at the addition of chemotherapy with carboplatin and paclitaxel or nab-paclitaxel in combination with pembrolizumab or placebo. And what it showed is there were significant survival benefits with the addition of pembrolizumab to chemotherapy in patients with squamous non-small cell lung cancer. And what's even more important is that benefit was actually preserved regardless of what your PD-L1 expression was. So patients actually with no level of PD-L1 expression in their tumor still gained a significant amount of benefit to chemotherapy plus immunotherapy. So these data are really significant, and I think it's particularly important in patients that have high levels of tumor burden, where they might be really quite symptomatic, where giving them chemotherapy in addition to the immunotherapy is probably better than giving them immunotherapy by itself, even if their level of PD-L1 expression is really high. So PD-L1 is the most important determinant. So if a patient has a high level of PD-L1, so PD-L1 TPS of 50% or more, those are patients that could potentially be candidates for immunotherapy by itself. I usually factor in the patient's age, performance status, their tumor burden, and essentially how quickly I need a response. So if you have a patient with a high tumor burden that's very symptomatic on the basis of their tumor burden, it might be much more prudent to add chemotherapy to the immunotherapy in these patients because you can induce a true tumor response quickly and hopefully make that patient feel better, as opposed to single-agent immunotherapy, where you always have that potential to have a patient that's an early progressor that might deteriorate very quickly. I think the greatest challenges with squamous as opposed to non-squamous is that we don't really have targetable oncogenic drivers. In adenocarcinoma, there's a good proportion of patients where you can find a genomic driver that can be targeted with a pill, and unfortunately in squamous we still don't have that. A number of genomic subsets have been looked at, such as patients with FGFR alterations. Unfortunately, nothing's really panned out in terms of practice changing. The good news is that many of these cancers are smoking related and tend to do very well with immunotherapy. But with that being said, we could definitely do better. And if we're still able to do efforts in identifying genomic subsets that could potentially be treated with targeted therapies, that would really be a great advance.
Ongoing research is examining how PD-L1 expression and tumor mutational burden can be used in a complementary fashion to predict which patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer will benefit most from immunotherapy, said James G. Herman, MD, co-director of the Lung Cancer Program and professor of medicine in the Department of Medicine at University of Pittsburgh. In our interview, Herman, who is also a medical oncologist at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center Hillman Cancer Center and the UPMC Endowed Chair in Lung Cancer Research, discussed the work that has been done to elucidate biomarkers of response to immunotherapy and the necessity of molecular testing at the time of diagnosis.
Immunotherapy has become a central part of most therapies for lung cancer now, in the first line and second line setting and in combination therapies. And trying to predict who will best respond to immunotherapies is an ongoing process, And we're talking about two specific areas. One is the PD-L1 staining, which is, of course, the ligand for this checkpoint inhibitor. And the second one is tumor mutational burden, and how these can be potentially used to select patients for therapy or determine who will benefit most from immunotherapies, either singly or in combination. Nearly all trials from all different checkpoint inhibitors now incorporate some degree of biomarker to look for responses and clinical benefit. PD-L1 is really incorporated into nearly all clinical trials to at least assess where patients most benefit from those. And increasingly now with sequencing strategies, tumor mutational burden now is often looked at as well. PD-L1, at least for checkpoint inhibitors, is a good biomarker because it's actually the target for therapies. Anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-1 antibodies are those agents that have shown clinical efficacy in lung cancer. So looking for the presence of the marker for that pathway engagement is, of course, logical and has proven to be quite useful in determining who will benefit most from immune-based therapies with checkpoint inhibitors. Liquid biopsies are at present still in the discovery phase of their usefulness for at least their utility in immune-based predictions. Well established in the targeted agents, EGFR, ALK-ROS, BRAF, but in the area of immune-based therapies where liquid biopsies would be looking at the tumor mutational burden, they're at present really not fully developed, and I think they're exploratory at this point. There's the possibility that would be an additional biomarker of efficacy as tumor mutational burden has been looked at least from biopsies. Well, molecular testing for nearly all patients with non-small cell lung cancer is important, much more for adenocarcinomas where we have a greater chance for finding actionable mutations. But we want to exclude targetable therapies first and find out those because those provide great options for many patients. In terms of the immune therapy, PD-L1 testing really is very useful in most settings and in the first line setting allows us to select patients for immune therapy alone where they will benefit without requiring chemotherapy. In other settings, it may be helpful in determining the relative benefit, but is not always necessary to actually include patients on therapeutic approaches. They've both been looked at in the context of increasing efficacy of immune-based therapies, and so high PD-L1 staining is associated with better responses. High tumor mutational burden has also been shown in some studies to be associated with better clinical response. They're actually, though, independent. High PD-L1 and high tumor mutational burden don't often occur together, or at least appear to occur independently. So they're looking at two different mechanisms by which immune-based therapies may be effective, and so they're complementary.
We closed out the night with Timothy F. Burns, MD, PhD, an assistant professor of medicine in the Department of Medicine of the Division of Hematology and Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute and a medical oncologist at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, Hillman Cancer Center. In our interview, Burns shared with us that insight into the natural history of EGFR, ALK, and ROS1-positive non-small cell lung cancers has led to the development of novel targeted treatments in the frontline setting, as well as expanding options for those with progressive disease. Listen on to hear Burns discuss the frontline standards of care in EGFR, ALK, and ROS1-positive non-small cell lung cancer, optimal sequencing strategies, and the nuances of tissue and plasma-based sequencing.
In the last year or so, we've come to take our best drug, which is osimertinib, and actually move it to the first-line setting. And so this was controversial, both for EGFR as well as ALK. And over the last couple of years, we've realized that using our best drug first actually gives us the best success of treating our patients as safe as possible. What's been really exciting, I think, over the last year is what happens after those patients progress on osimertinib, which is our standard of care first-line therapy. The concern with using our best drug first is that we didn't have anything targeted to offer these patients. One of the issues with giving osimertinib first is that you didn't have anything after, and now that we have these other drugs, either FDA approved or on the way, I think it reassures a lot of us that after patients progress on osimertinib, that we still have another targeted option. The state of the art or the state of the science for both ALK-positive lung cancer, which is about 7% of adenocarcinomas, as well as ROS1-positive lung cancer, which is about 2% of adenocarcinomas in the lungs. And so these are both translocations. ALK we've known about for quite a while, and we've had a number of agents improved. And it's actually gotten to the point now where we're trying to figure out what is the best agent. And ALK has really been a success story. If you think about it, we found this this translocation in lung cancer cell line, 2007, we had an FDA-approved drug 4 years later, which is record time. That drug was crizotinib, which actually wasn't a great drug for this disease, and it's now been supplanted by three drugs which have shown increased activity in the first line setting, and one drug which has really become our standard called alectinib, which actually patients that are on alectinib generally can go almost 3 years before they progress on it in the first line setting. But we've kind of adopted a new drug, lorlatinib, which is actually a third generation tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and that seems to work in patients that have failed both crizotinib as well as the second generation drugs like alectinib. ROS1 was initially treated starting a couple of years ago with a drug called crizotinib, which we use again for ALK positive disease, but unlike its role in ALK where it wasn't such a great drug, it's actually a very good drug for ROS1 positive disease. And so patients have done quite well on crizotinib. However, they eventually progress. And when they progress, similar to what we do for ALK, there's a drug called lorlatinib, which also has activity against many of the ROS1 mutations that develop. So similarly to ALK, when patients progress, the majority of them will progress because they have second site mutations in ROS1. And lorlatinib has been shown to have high activity in that setting. When you're looking for a translocation, there are multiple ways to look for these. The surest way is to do a tumor biopsy, and there are multiple methods. For ALK, there's IHC, there's FISH, and there's next-generation sequencing. For ROS1, similarly, there's FISH, and there's also next-generation sequencing. The other option, and what often happens, is sometimes we can't biopsy these. We can't get a good lesion to biopsy. It's in a bone, and if it's in a bone, you can't do molecular testing. We do blood-based testing. And blood-based testing can be very effective. However, how you interpret blood-based testing is very important. So when you do your standard blood-based testing, whether it's a Guardant 360 or a Foundation, they do two things. One is they do sequencing of the blood of the DNA in the blood. They also do something called fusion capture, which is very inefficient. So it is not uncommon if you do a blood-based test to get a report that may even have a mutation in your gene, such as ALK or ROS1, but does not report the ALK or ROS1 fusion. And that causes confusion in doctors in the community. So you cannot depend on a blood-based test to tell you that it has an ALK translocation or ROS1. However, once you already know it's there, they never go away. If it's negative in a blood-based test, what you're using that blood-based test for is to look for second site mutations.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to ONC Live On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you would like to learn about the treatment paradigm in hematologic malignancies, consider registering for the February 25th State of the Science Summit in Brooklyn, New York. We will also be holding a State of the Science Summit on lung cancer on March 5th in Scottsdale, Arizona. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. ONC Live is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at ONC Live and ONC Live SOSS. On Facebook, like us at ONC Live and ONC Live State of the Science Summit, and follow our ONC Live page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of ONC Live On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to ONC Live On Air.